Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Marcy Krivenin.
And I'm Elise Thatcher. A Snowmass town councilman faces a felony charge after allegedly trashing a jail cell.
Aspenites will probably vote on a proposed affordable lodge.
A judge considers whether the Aspen Skiing Company is at fault for a mudslide that damaged a home.
We take a look at diversity in the Roaring Fork Valley arts community.
And we also get a tour of an innovative marijuana grow facility in the valley.
Growing numbers of residents in Pitkin County are living in poverty.
And more small children are being removed from their homes in Garfield County over neglect and abuse.
Finally, we talked to a woman who led a major conservation effort in the valley for more than a decade.
That's coming up on Mountain Edition.
A Snowmass town councilman is facing a felony charge of criminal mischief. Chris Jacobson allegedly caused thousands of dollars in damage at the Pitkin County Jail. Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen reports.
Jacobson is accused of causing $14,500 in damage at the jail last month. Jacobson was arrested for drunk driving in the early morning hours of June 26th. Once he got in jail, he allegedly ripped things off the walls of the holding cells he was placed in. That included unbolting from the floor a restraint chair he was in. Pitkin County Sheriff Joe DeSavo says one of the holding cells where Jacobson did damage will be out of commission for 3 weeks while repairs are made. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
Aspen organizers turned in more than 1,000 signatures this week in hopes of getting a public vote on a hotel. Marcia Goshorn is one of the leaders of the petition drive.
We've had people that come up to me and other people saying that they don't necessarily want their name on it because they have a renovation on a bathroom or something that they want to put through, and it makes them very nervous because they have to go before the planning office to do that.
Aspen City Council approved the Base 2 Lodge, but some residents believe it's not the right fit for town.
The project in question is by downtown landlord Mark Hunt. There's a trial this week about a mudslide that took out a multi-million dollar home on a ski area in the Upper Valley. A homeowner is suing the Aspen Skiing Company in Pitkin County Court. Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen reports.
Andrew and Marilee Sapphire filed suit against the Ski Co. after a mudslide violently crashed through their Buttermilk home in May of 2011. They claim it did $2 million in damage and that the Ski Co. is liable because it cut a water diversion ditch near a ski access road above their home, causing the slope to fail. The company's lawyer, Kevin Bridston, argues the mudslide was an act of God and therefore it could not be prevented. In court Tuesday, he argued the triggering event happened the week before the mudslide when 10 inches of wet, heavy snow fell on the ski area. Andrew Sapphire, who, perhaps ironically, shares a private drive with the owners of the Ski Co., was the first witness to testify in what is expected to be a 6-day trial. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
Recreation and oil and gas development in the area will be affected by a new plan released Wednesday. It was put together by the Bureau of Land Management.
The resource management plan applies to BLM lands in 6 counties, including Garfield, Eagle, and Pitkin. It updates a 1984 plan and directs management for the next 2 decades. The majority of high potential acreage for oil and gas production has already been leased. Still, the new plan closes 98,000 acres to future leasing. David Boyd is a BLM spokesman.
That includes state wildlife areas, areas that we're managing to maintain wilderness characteristics. There's some lands we have within municipal boundaries and just some other areas of environmental critical environmental concern.
The plan also gives a new designation to the 9,100-acre Crown Mountain area in Pitkin and Garfield counties. It's now a special recreation management area. That's good news for mountain bikers, says Mike Pritchard with the Roaring Fork Mountain Bike Association.
The idea is that it will be managed with mountain bike experiences as one of the focuses. And that means that they are willing to consider new trails in the coming years, as much as 12 to 15 miles of new mountain bike-focused trails.
The plan is separate from another BLM analysis that's examining oil and gas leases on White River National Forest land in the Thompson Divide. That plan will come out this fall for public review.
Major support for Aspen Public Radio's environmental reporting comes from the John Denver Aspen Glow Fund at the Aspen Community Foundation, promoting responsible stewardship of the lands and wilderness of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Marcy Griffin, and if you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
The diversity and makeup of art museum leadership and displays has long been a topic of debate and discussion in the art world. With race now becoming one of the nation's most talked about issues, Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort explores how the art community in the Roaring Fork Valley is working through this discussion.
Good morning, Harvey Meadows Gallery.
At the Harvey Meadows Gallery on Hopkins Avenue in Aspen, Sam Harvey answers the phone as he tends to his space. He runs the gallery with his business partner, Allegheny Meadows. Sam is what you'd call a needle in a haystack. He's a black man who runs an art gallery in Aspen. For Harvey, the main issue surrounding art and diversity is the ability for people to access it.
It's an accessibility thing, having access to platforms to show your work and engage in the larger Aspen community. And there are not that many places to show work. We don't really have kind of a public venue to show artwork in this town. If there was a gallery that was non-commercial, it could take more risks with a diverse spectrum of artwork.
Harvey says one of his dreams is to open a non-profit gallery so that the kind of art he's talking about can be displayed. According to Sam, the problem is money. If you don't own your space, your first priority can't be on what message you want to send with your art. It just has to be able to sell. Angie Callum, the executive director of the Red Brick Center for the Arts, agrees with Harvey's analysis of the profit-nonprofit divide.
In a lot of cases, when you're trying to diversify or step outside the box or explore new territory, there is some kind of financial restriction there that may make it seem not worth it.
Just a few blocks away from Harvey's gallery is the Aspen Art Museum. Heidi Zuckerman is the CEO of the museum and explained a program that aims to bring in members of the Valley's Latino community. She says reaction has been positive.
The one that Michelle really called out was a woman who specifically said, I would not come here had I not been invited. So I wouldn't come to a museum, I wouldn't, you know, be interested in contemporary art, but I would not come here unless I had been invited.
Zuckerman says the museum has attempted to remove any barriers of entry to minorities in the area by making admission free and holding events where members of the Hispanic community were directly invited. Zuckerman claimed that the museum showcased more solo exhibitions by women and artists of color than any other in the country. Though the list of exhibits is diverse, museum officials could not verify her claim. A short drive away, the Carbondale Council on Arts and Humanities is trying to do similar things for its community.
We've seen how much more engaged they are right now than 15 years ago. I've been at the Arts Council for 11, 12 years. So I've really seen the difference and the difference that it makes. And it's a lot of fun and it feels really good.
That's Amy Kimmerly, the executive director of the council. She says that her community poses challenges to reaching the larger Hispanic community. Carbondale has nearly three times as many Latino residents as Aspen does, according to U.S. Census data. Through outreach programs similar to ones at the Aspen Art Museum, the Carbondale Council on Arts and Humanities has managed to involve local minorities. Their strategy is by starting young, reach out to children who then involve their parents. But Kimberly also feels that race isn't the only way that members of the art establishment need to think about diversity.
You know, diversity in this area can be anything from economic status to age to nationality. So
Sam Harvey agrees.
For me, it's not a black or white issue. It's not African Americans and white people. It's the ideal of America, which is a platform where everyone can participate. And I think that's a lofty goal, lofty and worthy goal to support.
Does outreach work? Does creating a space for public work solve it? In the end, the problem is finding out what real progress looks like. Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
The marijuana industry in Colorado got some attention at the Aspen Ideas Festival last week. Festival participants toured a grow operation near Basalt and heard from experts about the somewhat bumpy rollout of recreational pot.
There's a few rules before you take a tour of High Valley Farms near Basalt.
You can come in. We have booties put over your shoes once you've signed in.
Besides slipping surgical booties over your shoes, the staff, dressed in scrubs, asks for your ID. Pass holders and participants of the Aspen Ideas Festival are on this tour. Guide and High Valley Farms CEO Jordan Lewis leads the group into the first of four greenhouses.
So this house, these plants over here are all mother plants, and this is what we use for the propagation.
He points to rows of several healthy-looking plants.
So we'll take clones off of these, which essentially is a cutting, something like this, and then we put it into a rooting hormone and a cube, and it takes about 10 days to 2 weeks to form new roots, and essentially it becomes a new plant.
This facility is small compared to others on the Front Range. With 25,000 square feet of space and 3,000 plants, it supplies product to a store in Aspen. It's highly engineered. Plants are closely monitored, and conditions like humidity and temperature are tightly controlled. In the more pungent flowering greenhouse, the plants are taller and closer to harvest.
Over here you'll see, this is a plant that's just starting to form female flowers. These white pistils and these bud sites are all going to grow quite significantly over the next 7 weeks. These are about a week and a half to 2 weeks into flowering at the moment.
What do you think so far?
This is beyond impressive and inspiring.
Scott Brittingham is on the tour. He's from Santa Barbara.
This is a dream I had when I was 16 years old, and now I'm 53 and I got to see it come true. It's pretty cool.
The dream of legally growing and selling marijuana didn't come true overnight. Andrew Friedman, Colorado's marijuana coordinator, says after voters approved it in 2012, the rollout was challenging.
And this was not an easy task because we have no guidelines. We also, the vote in some ways tore apart communities, so we had to bring those communities back together to discuss how to roll out. And we actually don't have the federal government here to help us roll it out.
He says it's been a successful start, with some exceptions, like an increased number of cannabis-related emergency room visits. Friedman spoke on an Ideas Fest panel alongside High Valley Farms' Jordan Lewis Friday. Lewis says it's a challenging business environment. Laws are rapidly changing, and banks fear federal punishment and won't work with pot outfits.
The level of burden that's placed upon both the businesses and the banks that want to work with us is, I don't think it's going to, something has to give. It's, we're reaching a point where the amount of revenue and the size of the industry is growing to a point where it's not manageable unless we fix it.
Though it's still working out kinks, this new industry is bringing in a new revenue stream to the state. Taxes on pot sales this fiscal year will generate an estimated $68 million, and officials with Colorado's tourism office say pot has bumped up visitation slightly. Back at High Valley Farms, the tour is wrapping up. Jordan Lewis guides the group into a small room where plants are drying and curing.
So this is what the finished product looks like. You know, you take off all this extra leaf around the flowers, and that's what is essentially what you sell in the store.
Outside the greenhouse, Dallas resident Richard Saxon says he's surprised at how precise the growth process is.
I thought they were just growing plants like somebody's vegetable garden in their backyard. But clearly it's highly scientific, highly regulated. Any concerns I might have had about black market stuff, it's so tightly controlled. I'm just really overwhelmed by what I saw.
Neighbors near High Valley Farms have complained about odor. Just this month, the facility installed a new system with the hope it will eliminate smell. Marcy Krivenin, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. The Great Recession may be in the rearview mirror, but left poverty in its wake. Pitkin County's Health and Human Services Department reports more people living in poverty.
Director of the department, Nan Sundin, says a quarter of residents earn slightly more than federal poverty wages. So many single adults are making just $23,000 a year. I spoke with Sundin this week.
Approximately 4,525 residents, about 25% of our population, live at 200% of poverty, which is, you know, a result of our service industry positions, the fact that after 2008, businesses pared down. People are less likely to be working two and three jobs now. They're lucky if they have one job, and that job is paying less than it did in 2008.
I mean, it's hard to imagine, like you said, living on that amount of money here when even what might be considered a good wage somewhere else is low in this area.
People look at our median income at $72,000 and they think, oh, you know, they're all so rich in Pitkin County, but that's the middle income, which means they're a lot below and they're a lot above. We have to look at the cost of living and really look at the fact that, in particular, the city of Aspen and the valley and Pitkin County have really important subsidies that help us keep some diversity of income in our community. But it's becoming more and more difficult for people to live here successfully on those low wages.
Why is it important to have a diversity of income within a community?
You know, what we know from all best practice is that diversity in a community is what brings the richness of culture and of community and a sense of place. And if we had all middle-income or high-income people here, you know, we wouldn't have the richness that people of all incomes and all races and all lifestyles bring to our community. It's what makes Pitkin, and in particular Aspen, attractive to the international world, is that we have a real community that lives here.
So you presented this to the Aspen Chamber Resort Association. Why did you present it to that group?
I presented to ACRA the information about poverty because we really want to talk about the lack of access for low-income people to medical care, to health care.
Nan Sundin is director of Pitkin County Health and Human Services. Next week, we'll examine access to health care for the poor. Law enforcement and community members are putting together a memorial service for a parachute child who died last month.
Sarah Ogden was 4 weeks old when she was pronounced dead at the Grand River Hospital in Rifle. Garfield County Coroner Rob Glassmeyer lives near the apartment complex where Ogden and her family resided.
We realized that there was no family around, there was nobody to care for her remains, care for her service. And we thought as a community we should pull together to remember her.
Ogden died of multiple blunt force injuries, and Glassmeyer says her passing has been tough for folks in the Parachute and Battlement Mesa area.
To have such a young child killed in a felonious act is, I think, devastating to the community, and it's really heartbreaking for everybody that you talk to.
So he and members of the Sheriff's Office, Fire District, School District, and other parts of the community are coordinating a memorial service for this Friday evening. The District Attorney's Office has charged Ogden's father, Matthew Ogden, with a felony of first-degree child abuse resulting in death. That's similar to a murder charge. He's also charged with reckless and negligent child abuse resulting in death. The child's mother, Phyllis Amy Wyatt, has been charged with felony child abuse resulting in death. both have criminal history in at least one other state. As of Wednesday, the Garfield County Sheriff's Office is working to bring them back to Colorado from Minnesota, where they were arrested. District Attorney Sherry Kaloya says it's been a long time since the DA's office handled a child homicide.
Approximately 11 years ago, a very similar instance to the case that we have now.
Kaloya says in that case, the father was also charged with murder and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. Mary Bedarian is Human Services Director with Garfield County.
One trend that we have been seeing in Garfield County, particularly in the last 2.5 to 3 years, is a much higher level of placement of small children.
Bedarian, who's recovering from a bad cold, means her office has been moving more small children out of their homes.
Primarily due to neglect, and a large percentage of those, I believe approximately 80%, a little higher, were substance involved.
Parents were using drugs, couldn't seem to get a handle on it, and the children were in danger. Kids who are removed from their homes are placed with vetted family members or close friends. What could be causing more of them to be in dangerous homes in the first place? Bedarian says there's a couple of possible factors in play. First, Garfield County has a lot of young families. Also,
we have seen a significant increase in methamphetamine, particularly since the recession. And the recession has not left Garfield County. We're still seeing a lot of folks struggling.
It's not clear whether drugs or not enough money at home may have played a role in Sarah Ogden's death. Coroner Rob Glassmeyer wants to make sure finances don't get in the way of her being properly remembered. He and fellow community members are also raising money to pay for her cremation and memorial items for her twin brother, as well as possibly a park bench dedicated in her honor.
We felt that it was important to have that memorial service, and then we figured in 15, 20, 30 years, there should be something that we can walk by and remember, oh yeah, we remember this little girl, and we remember what happened, and we're not going to forget about child abuse awareness in our community.
Elise Thatcher, Aspen Public Radio News. For decades, the Aspen Valley Land Trust has kept open spaces in the Roaring Fork Valley from being developed. Now the organization's director is preparing to step down.
I sat down with Martha Cochran, who says the work AVLT has done to permanently preserve land is not just critical for views and historic land uses like ranching. It's important for wildlife.
Here, all the private land is on the valley floors, pretty much, which is the critical land in the winter. It's where the water is. And so, as you think about areas to conserve, you usually start high with the public lands and then connect down to a river corridor. So we're always looking for those key corridors, migration corridors for wildlife.
Many tens of thousands of acres have been preserved by the Aspen Valley Land Trust, correct?
Correct. There's about 40,000 acres. And acres sometimes don't tell the story. I think the other important thing is more than 60 miles of stream frontage. So clean air, clean water, this is the most important thing you can do for that. And also the water rights. So if there's water on the land that we conserve, that has to stay there. So it can't be converted to municipal use or diverted to the Front Range.
Can you give an example of a land parcel that has been preserved by the Aspen Valley Land Trust?
The visible ones, the Watson Divide, that ranch is about an 800-acre conservation easement. And it has a house up on top, and it has a provision to build barns, hay sheds, that sort of thing, and that's all. Another one is the Jackson Ranch, closer to Glenwood. It's 300 acres on both sides of the road. It's about a mile of the Roaring Fork River. It's kind of the, especially as you get down into Garfield County, it's really such an obvious open space because it's one of the last ones left.
The Aspen Times interviewed you, and you describe yourself as a farm girl at heart. You know, is that why you're doing this kind of work? Is that what attracted you to it?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I grew up on land and I working land, and I just like land. I've had a career of land use, planning, you know, being on P&Z, city council, I just think the way we structure our physical environment is critical. And I also believe that we are losing connection to that, where our food comes from, what does make clean water. You know, it's not the what's in the stream, it's what's around the stream. And I think that we need to just look at our environment and be more careful with how we treat it.
And this is one way of doing that.
Yes, yes. You know, we plan, build in urban centers, confine things. We need open land. As long as we have land, you can take care of yourself, you can have wildlife, you can have clean water and air. If you don't have land, you don't have any of that.
When I think of the Roaring Fork Valley, I think of dollar signs when it comes to land.
Right.
Especially maybe in terms of development. So how difficult is it? Is it increasingly difficult, I guess, to get people on board to do this?
Oddly enough, it's not. And I think that part of that is that the landowning population is aging. Past a certain point, this is a general statement, it's not about the money. Everybody, every single one of those would make two or three times, four times as much money by selling their land. It's not about the money, it's about what's important to them. And people that live on the land and love that land, that's the most important thing to them.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Martha Cochran has served as executive director of Aspen Valley Land Trust for 13 years. She's stepping down at the end of the year, but intends to stay in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Aspen residents and visitors have had a little more elbow room this week. The July 4th stretch is one of the busiest on the resort's calendar, and the epicenter last week was the Aspen Institute's campus. It's home to the Aspen Ideas Festival, Jazz Aspen Snowmass, and the Aspen Music Festival and School. And one longtime local was on the front lines directing the thousands of people passing through there.
You can take this left, work your way to Hallam Street. Hallam Street runs right behind it.
Perfect, thank you. No sense of direction.
Basalt resident James Jerome stands at a key entrance to the Aspen Institute.
I've been working in the Gillespie Street and 3rd Street North parking traffic control area.
He's with a private security company handling a steady stream of people walking, biking, and driving cars to the Aspen Ideas Festival or Jazz Aspen Snowmass. And they usually need a little guidance, whether they want it or not.
Directions, where things are at, where can they park is a big question.
And have you been here every day?
Every day since the Institute opened, yes. This is my fifth year of doing it at this spot, so I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the people that are local that live along Roaring Fork Drive, and they have all kinds of workers that come in. I recognize most of them, or they recognize me.
And when visitors ask about parking, he often has to turn them away from the big lot right next to him.
They have to park out in the residential area. And that becomes kind of a problem Monday through Friday because most of it is marked 2-hour parking only.
But you just roll with it and explain to them for the 17th time that, you know.
Yeah. 1,000 times a day, sometimes the same question. Where can we park? And I let them know. Typical thing in Aspen, parking is limited. My job to me is to treat the people coming in with respect and dignity and make it a good, enjoyable experience for them.
James Jerome says what he'll remember most this year is briefly meeting Jimmy and Rosalind Carter when their motorcade arrived at the campus last month. That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. Have a nice afternoon. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Marcy Grevenen. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.